You know that really specific, like, visceral panic when you're navigating an unfamiliar city
Yeah.
and you look down at your phone and the battery icon is glowing red at 1%?
Oh yeah, pure survival mode.
Right. You instantly just drop everything. You dim the screen until you can barely even see it. You start aggressively swiping away every background app.
Firing off that frantic text to your family, like, phone dying, love you.
Exactly. And then the screen just goes black. And you are entirely disconnected.
We treat that glowing red line like a literal biological threat. I mean, it's a very modern, very specific kind of anxiety we've just completely normalized.
Yeah.
We accept that our access to the world is totally contingent on a lithium-ion battery.
But imagine for a second if that battery meter wasn't sitting in the palm of your hand. Like, imagine it was hovering constantly in the peripheral vision of your own eye.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it wasn't measuring your device's electricity, it was measuring your brain's biological capacity, your actual physical ability to pay attention, to feel empathy, or to, you know, even remember your own life.
It's a literal visible battery meter for human consciousness.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're immersing ourselves in this brilliant, meticulously detailed, speculative teleplay script called Fair Usage.
It is such a good read.
It really is. And our mission today is to tear apart the mechanics of this terrifying attention economy it builds. We're going to dissect how it forces one working-class mother to choose between her professional empathy and her personal memories.
And ultimately, we want to uncover what this fictional universe reveals about, well, your own daily struggles with presence and distraction.
Because what makes fair usage so devastating isn't some fiery apocalyptic ruin. You aren't looking at a wasteland here.
No, not at all. The brilliance of this script lies in its total suffocating banality.
Right.
It paints this quiet bureaucratic dystopia where the ultimate out-of-reach luxury isn't a flying car or a mansion. It is simply the ability to be fully present in your own life.
The world building is just so grounded it hurts. So the script establishes that 8 years prior to the story, this monolithic corporation called Loom Cognitive successfully mapped the human connectome.
They basically patented the biological pathways of human thought.
Exactly. And now society operates on what they call assisted cognition. Literally every adult uses the Loom mesh.
And we really need to look at how that actually works on a sensory level. Because Loom didn't just map the brain, they figured out how to intercept and throttle the electrical signals of perception.
It's wild. The user interface is a diegetic heads-up display, a HUD, that just floats in the corner of your eye.
Right. And the current software version they're all running is ominously titled Loom Runtime, Fable 5.
That name alone is so creepy.
It really is. So Loom optimizes your perception, your attention, and your memory, but it meters those functions exactly like a telecom company metering computer processing power.
The actual interface for this is so brutal. Users have this thing called an effort slider. It's described as a pill-shaped slider in your vision, labeled faster on one end and smarter on the other.
And the tiers are Eco, Standard, Deep, and Ultra Code.
Right, so think of your brain's capacity under the system like a computer's random access memory, like RAM. That's your context window.
And this is where the rigid class system of the Loon universe just completely solidifies. The elite tiers, like the wealthy executives who can actually afford the premium subscription, they get a massive 1.0 million context window.
Which means they can hold infinite sensory details, emotional nuances, complex thoughts, all simultaneously.
Exactly. Well, the working class gets a severely throttled 128K context window.
Okay, wait, let me play devil's advocate for just a second here.
Go for it.
If I'm doing my taxes or I'm, I don't know, standing in line at the DMV, I want to be checked out. Like, if this HUD offloads the boring, mundane tasks so my brain can just run on autopilot, doesn't that free up my mental bandwidth for what actually matters?
I mean, it sounds like an incredible biological life hack, right?
Yeah.
And that is exactly the utopian promise Loom likely used to sell the technology initially. But the reality is a hard paywall. You don't actually get to save that bandwidth.
Right, because there's a limit.
A strict one. There is a 5-hour rolling cap on sustained effort and a hard weekly limit on all effort modes that resets every Sunday at midnight.
which just sounds like old cell phone minutes.
It really does. And when you exceed your limit, you don't fall asleep or pass out. Your experience gets compacted.
I found the compaction concept deeply, deeply unsettling.
It's horrifying. Think about having a severely outdated computer trying to run modern software. You can only hold a few pieces of sensory information in your working memory before the system forces you to close out tabs.
But in fair usage, closing out tabs means everything you see and hear is auto-summarized into a dry, text-based gist right there on your HUD.
Your own lived experience is reduced to bullet points in real time. It strips away the visual and emotional details of the world around you just to keep you physically functioning.
Now, someone might ask, well, why wouldn't you just tear the mesh out? Opt out entirely, go off the grid.
The script addresses that beautifully, actually. Relying on raw, unmetered legacy cognition in a world that is totally optimized by Loom leaves you functioning at a severe deficit.
You process information way too slowly to hold a job.
Exactly. You can't interface with basic civic infrastructure, and you are effectively rendered a social pariah. You are forced to participate.
And these architectural rules of the Loom Mesh, they aren't just background lore to make the script look cool. They create this immediate, devastating mathematical crisis for anyone in the working class.
Particularly those in caregiving professions.
Yes, because your job literally drains your cognitive bank account before you even clock out for the day. And we see this exact nightmare play out with our protagonist, Mara.
Mara is a 38-year-old hospice nurse. And the opening scene places her right at the bedside of her 91-year-old patient, Ruth.
Ruth is actively dying, and she looks at Mara and says, "You're not all the way here."
Which is such a gut punch.
It is, because Ruth was a nurse herself for 40 years, long before the Loom Mesh even existed. And she tells Mara, "I know the difference between present and rendered."
That single line exposes the entire emotional deficit of this world. Ruth intuitively senses that Mara is running her cognitive slider on standard effort.
Mara's body is physically in the room. Her vital signs are stable. She is technically doing her job.
But she is merely rendered. She is completely hollowed out emotionally.
So Mara looks at her HUD, sees the deficit, and she tries to escalate her work profile to deep effort so she can actually bear witness to Ruth's final moments.
But the system flat out denies the request.
Her employer will not pay for that level of empathy for a standard patient.
Right, so Mara makes this split-second decision to use her own personal cognitive allowance to override the system lock.
And the sensory shift the script describes when she spends her own tokens is profound. The world doesn't get louder, it gets deeper.
The ambient room tone suddenly blooms in her ears. She notices the delicate flutter of a moth against the window screen.
She registers the exact institutional green of the hospice wall. She is finally, fully alive, absorbing Ruth's passing with absolute, unmetered human dignity.
But then, literally the moment Ruth passes, the HUD chimes with this cheerful, completely tone-deaf notification.
That's all I hated that part.
It says, "Session complete, personal weekly remaining, 19%. Nice work today."
The whiplash from profound grief to gamified corporate metrics is just jarring.
And the fallout from that override is incredibly swift. Mara is summoned to the hospice administrator's office.
The administrator, Dennis Pale, he represents the ultimate banality of corporate evil. Like, he isn't a mustache-twirling villain.
No, he's just a middle manager with a lanyard pointing to a corporate policy poster.
Right. He points to the tier poster eco, standard, deep, ultra code, and casually explains that wealthy families pay for deep certified facilities, working class families get standard.
And then he looks Mara in the eye and delivers the most chilling line of the first act. He says, "Standard isn't a limitation, Mara. Standard is the product."
Wow. He is laying out the brutal math of the care economy right there.
And he follows it up with a warning that really drives Mara's entire character arc. He tells her, "Every point of empathy you spend in here comes out of your kid's bedtime."
They've turned human empathy into a literal zero-sum game. Caring for a dying stranger means you are mathematically required to emotionally starve your own child.
If we pull this concept into reality for a moment, I mean, this is a horrifyingly literal translation of compassion fatigue.
Oh, absolutely.
Caregivers today in nursing, teaching, social work, they routinely give so much of their emotional reserves at work that they return home to their families completely depleted.
The writers of Fair Usage have simply taken that very real, invisible psychological phenomenon and quantified it into a tangible token system.
And Dennis's warning manifests. The second day, Mara walks through her front door. The math catches up to her.
Right, because Mara has a 9-year-old daughter named June.
And June is a crucial element here because she is unmetered.
Right. In this society, children are not integrated into the Loom Mesh until their 13th birthday.
So June is broadcasting at maximum bandwidth. She is vibrant, perceptive, just overflowing with energy.
While Mara, conversely, having spent her weekly tokens at the hospice, is trapped on eco mode.
Mara is effectively looking at her own daughter through a frosted window.
It's so sad. June is animatedly telling a story about her day, but Mara's HUD is just feeding her a text box summarizing the interaction. It literally says, emotional valence, positive, requires response.
And Mara replies with this generic, that's great, bug.
June immediately stops her story, looks at her mother, and says, Mom, you're buffering.
Hearing a child tell their parent, you're buffering, just encapsulates the entire tragedy of their relationship.
It really does. But the true devastation of Mara's cognitive deficit hits at June's Spring Strings recital.
Oh, this scene.
June is on stage about to play Ashokan Farewell on the violin. Mara is in the auditorium, leaning forward in her plastic chair, just desperate to take in every detail of her daughter's performance.
But her context window hits 99% capacity.
Right as June draws her bow across the strings, the HUD violently interrupts. Context window full, compaction in progress.
And the sensory drain is described in agonizing detail. The rich acoustics of the auditorium thin out to a tinny buzz.
The visual fidelity of the room degrades, and most brutally, June's face shifts from being specifically her daughter's face to just a generic, vaguely rendered child's face.
And then a text overlay literally blocks Mara's vision. It says, June performed Ashokan Farewell, minor error, bar 12. Audience applauded. You felt proud.
And right next to the word proud, there is a small parenthetical that says est.
Estimated. The algorithm is estimating a mother's pride based on biometric data because her brain lacks the processing power to actually feel the emotion.
She is watching an auto-generated summary of her child from 20 feet away. She is entirely disconnected from the present moment.
If you're Mara, you are totally trapped in this system. You can't earn more empathy at your day job without neglecting your kid, and you can't save your capacity at home without being a ghost.
She needs a side hustle, but in an economy where human consciousness is the only commodity of value, you are forced to literally sell pieces of your own soul.
Exactly. So a fellow nurse introduces Mara to a gig economy app called Attend.
And Attend exposes this bizarre, deeply cynical quirk of this society's class divide.
Right. Because wealthy individuals have incredibly demanding schedules, but their cognitive weeklies are treated as precious capital.
They will physically attend social obligations like weddings, graduations, christenings, but they deliberately keep their own cognitive slider locked on eco mode.
They're hoarding their tokens for high-stakes business deals or, you know, exclusive retreats.
But they still want the event witnessed for the family archive. They want the memory recorded in full emotional fidelity, so they hire working-class proxies through the Attend app to feel the emotions for them.
The wealthy are outsourcing their emotional labor. They effectively turn the working class into emotional surrogates.
I was trying to contextualize this, and it's essentially like TaskRabbit or Uber. But instead of renting out your car or assembling a bookshelf, you are renting out your central nervous system to feel a stranger's joy.
It is so dystopian. So Mara accepts a gig attending a graduation reception for a wealthy family, the Lambs.
She gets granted a loaner tier for the duration of the job, a massive 1.0M ultra-code context window.
And suddenly, the world is overwhelmingly, almost painfully detailed. She registers the microscopic tremor in the graduating teenager's hand.
She smells the specific bitter aroma of the hotel coffee.
And the wealthy parents are standing right there, completely checked out, their eyes just glazed over in eco mode.
Meanwhile, Mara, who is a total stranger, she's never met this kid. She is sitting in the back row, openly weeping. She is the only human being in that room, actually, at the graduation.
She is bearing the profound emotional weight of a milestone that doesn't even belong to her.
And the physical reality of how she gets compensated grounds the dystopia so brilliantly. Like, she doesn't just tap a button on her phone to transfer the file.
No, she has to go to a mundane strip mall kiosk.
Yeah, one that's sandwiched between a discount tax preparer and a vape shop.
The indignity of the extraction process is wild. She sits in this fluorescent-lit room, signs a legal waiver stating she experienced the event in good faith.
And then a technician literally siphons the high-fidelity memory directly from her connectome to license to the Lamb family. And she walks out with 380 effort credits.
This brings us to the core thesis of fair usage. I mean, this isn't just a story about evil technology run amok. It is a story about how hypercapitalism inevitably commodifies whatever is most precious.
In this world, the ultimate luxury good isn't an object, it is human presence.
Right. So Mara begins this grueling cycle. She needs these credits to spend on her own daughter.
We see a montage of her working gig after gig on Attend at UltraCode. She goes to retirements, she goes to funerals. She just weeps at the milestones of strangers.
But the cruel ironies of the system dictate that to stockpile those credits, she has to live her own actual life on eco mode for 3 straight weeks.
Dinners with June arrive completely pre-summarized. She willingly bankrupts herself emotionally at home so she can afford to purchase one perfect, unmetered memory of her own life.
Which leads to the climax of the narrative, the lake.
Yes. Mara finally amasses enough credits to purchase an Ultra Code day pass. One full day, zero cognitive limits, maximum sensory detail.
The script notes a stark visual shift here, too. This sequence at the lake is the only scene in the entire teleplay shot in fully saturated, vibrant color.
It's a great detail. So Mara redeems the pass at 9:00 a.m. sharp. They arrive at the lake, and it is glorious.
The text really emphasizes the granular, perfect details. June is skipping stones and narrating her failures.
They are eating pistachio ice cream, and Mara can actually taste the salt, the cold, the roasted nuts.
And amidst all this vivid beauty, they encounter Gerald.
A duck. A single judgmental duck staring at them from the shoreline.
Naturally.
Naturally. June names him Gerald. Mara, soaking in the moment, asks, why Gerald?
And June delivers this with perfect 9-year-old philosophical deadpan. She says, because Gerald has seen things, Mom. Every piece of bread is a surprise to Gerald. He keeps no records, and yet he persists.
It is such a beautifully absurd piece of childhood logic. And because Mara is running on Ultra Code, she feels the joke reverberate through her entire body.
She laughs from the absolute bottom of her soul. She hoards the timing of the delivery, the exact shade of the green water behind the duck. She is desperately saving every pixel of this day.
But the Ultra Code session is a rental. It has a hard stop.
Yeah.
At exactly 8:10 p.m., the session terminates.
The saturated color instantly drains out of the world, returning to the muted gray of standard mode.
And as they sit by the dimming lake, the Loom app materializes in Mara's vision with just an agonizing prompt.
It asks, keep this day. Loom plus retention, $89 a month. Without retention, memories are compacted to summary after 30 days.
The business model is pure extortion. I mean, charging a premium for the experience of the moment is predatory enough. But monetizing the nostalgia of that moment crosses into profound evil. They are taking her own lived history and holding it for ransom.
It poses a terrifying philosophical question about memory ownership.
Mm.
I mean, Mara sacrificed 3 weeks of her life acting as an emotional vessel for strangers just to orchestrate this one perfect day with her daughter.
And the ultimate gut punch is realizing that without an ongoing financial subscription, she doesn't legally or biologically own the contents of her own mind.
So Mara pulls up her banking interface. She has exactly $61 to her name. Rent is due on the 1st.
She looks at June, who is asleep against her shoulder, and she slowly reaches up and hits decline.
And then the narrative jumps forward 29 days. The retention grace period is expiring.
Mara is lying in bed, desperately trying to recall the day at the lake before the system compacts it.
She pulls up her internal archive, and the vibrant, beautiful day has been replaced by a sterile, low-res text summary.
It says, ate ice cream, skipped stones, encountered duck, June made jokery duck. And then the absolute worst part, June said, detail unavailable.
Detail unavailable.
Mara reaches into her mind for the punchline of the joke. She tries to remember why the duck was named Gerald. And the script describes it as reaching into dark water for a coin that was never dropped.
The information is simply gone.
The memory hasn't naturally faded either.
No, it has been artificially decayed by the Loom Corporation to save server space on a non-paying account.
So Mara calls out to her daughter. June sleepily wanders into the bedroom and says, you were different that day at the lake. You were all the way here.
Mara, quietly panicking, asks her, tell me about the duck.
And June's face lights up. She recounts the entire story with flawless precision, complete recall, every beat, the exact deadpan timing.
She remembers because as a 9-year-old, she is unmetered.
Yeah.
She is the last person in their family who actually possesses her own memories.
Mara is sitting there crying and laughing, relying on her own child to feed back the missing details of her own life.
It feels like this moment of victory, right? This beautiful, bittersweet human connection circumventing the technology.
It does. But then the camera slowly pulls back. It drifts out of the bedroom, moves down the dark hallway, and settles in the kitchen, zooming in on the refrigerator.
And pinned to the fridge by a cheap souvenir magnet from the lake is a corporate letter. It says, Loom onboarding Juniper Voss, activation, 13th birthday. Welcome to fair usage.
The metered world is coming for her. Her childhood is on a ticking clock, and the corporate capitalization of her consciousness is inevitable.
It leaves the audience completely breathless. You realize June's perfect, unmetered memory isn't a triumph. It's a temporary state.
So we have to bridge this back to reality. For you, listening to this right now, we obviously don't have a Loom mesh surgically installed in our brains.
Not yet, anyway.
Right. But I want you to genuinely reflect on how you currently allocate your own attention. Like, think about the Attend app. Would you hire someone to go to your cousin's wedding, feel the joy for you, and just beam the emotional summary to your phone so you could keep working?
I mean, it sounds insane, but how often do we text congratulations while feeling absolutely nothing? Are we already living a softly compacted life? Like when we sit at the dinner table endlessly scrolling, or when we watch our kids' milestones through the screen of a smartphone?
Prioritizing the recording over the actual experience?
Yeah.
We might not have a visible effort slider in our eyes, but we are already trading our human presence for digital convenience. We are already voluntarily running on eco mode for the people we love most, just to keep up with the demands of the day.
And as technology rapidly advances, the central metaphors of fair usage become significantly less fictional.
Real-world tech companies are right now, today, actively developing direct neural links. Brain-computer interfaces are leaving the realm of science fiction.
And if that technology scales and becomes the societal standard, will we willingly opt into a subscription model for our own consciousness, simply to remain competitive in the modern workforce?
If opting out means becoming a slow, unoptimized legacy human, someone incapable of keeping pace with the processing speed of the global economy, will we inevitably sign the terms and conditions that surrender the copyright to our own memories?
It's a lot to think about.
Think back to that sharp, tightening panic you feel when your phone battery hits 1%. Now imagine that exact feeling, but it's your own mind fading to black. Would you pay $89 a month just to remember who you are?
It is a question you might want to answer the next time you feel yourself buffering.
Until next time, keep your eyes up.